This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us today. Today, our topic on the program is diet and nutrition. So we welcome your questions this afternoon for registered dietitian Susan Kundrat. She joins us once a month, usually on the first Monday of the month, to talk about diet and nutrition. So if you've got a question, give us a call. Here are the numbers. In the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Susan Kundrat is a sports and wellness nutritionist and the owner of Nutrition on the Move. She specializes in developing personalized nutrition plans for athletes and the general public. She's an adjunct lecturer with the Food Science and Human Nutrition Department at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. She's also a frequent contributor to magazines on health and fitness, and she's the author of 101 Sports Nutrition Tips. You'll find her on the web at www.nutritiononthemove.net. Questions about diet and nutrition? Give us a call, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else outside the Champaign-Urbana area, call us toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
It's been a while.
It has been.
We had a sub last month.
I was so glad to hear that you had Dave on there, because I had seen him, I guess, in Washington, D.C. We were at meetings together in November. Uh-huh. So we had talked about his new book, and I told him at that time, you know, it'd be really great if you were able to get on our nutrition show. And so I'm really glad that worked out.
It worked out fine.
He's a great guy.
Yeah. So, and the title is 101 Foods That Could Save Your Life.
That's right.
And you'll have to remind me of his last name.
Grotto. Dave Grotto.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In fact, I just got the copy of his book. He sent me a copy of it. So I know you saw it. So it is really interesting.
It's a lot of fun to look through.
And yeah.
It's kind of amazing. It's a lot of the things that we've talked about over the years is, you know, how our foods pack such a wonderful, they can. If you choose wisely.
Right. Yeah. Right.
We've got a listener already lined up and ready to go. So let's go and talk to this caller on a cell phone, line 4. Hi.
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 I wondered if your guest is able to answer a question about what might be good to eat or not eat prior to some facial surgery that might help to minimize bruising.
Well, I think if we look at nutrient-wise, what might be important are foods that could be high in vitamin C, which help with healing. And so in some cases, when people are going into surgery, they may increase vitamin C intake a little bit beforehand, and because it helps so much with healing. And so it would make sense to maybe consider that. If you supplement with vitamin C, probably 500 milligrams is a good amount, or maybe even up to 1,000 milligrams. You always want to be careful going into any surgery that you don't add a lot of supplements before, because some could be blood thinners. Another supplement that comes to mind that we know is helpful is vitamin E, because that's very helpful with the skin. But as a fat-based supplement, it's also could potentially be a blood thinner or work with other things to be a blood thinner. So,
right.
You know, smaller amounts of that would be helpful too. And that would be something like 100 or 200 IUs, perhaps, with vitamin E. But those things would make a lot of sense, because they could potentially help with that. After the surgery, then, too, we know that anti-inflammatory nutrients, like fish oils and things like that, again, if it's appropriate, you know, with your surgeon, sometimes decreases inflammation, which could help be helpful as well. And so those are things that I would actually ask your surgeon to see if those would be appropriate depending upon healing and those kinds of things. But then I think going into any kind of surgery too, really well nourished is helpful, because your body just has the nutrients on board maybe to heal faster. And I don't know per se if that would, you know, decrease bruising if the bruising is there and has to happen, but it might make you heal faster, which would be good.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
Well, good luck. We wish you a speedy recovery. Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other questions for registered dietitian Susan Kundrat? Give us a call, 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Well, here we are in February, and it is Heart Health Month.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you've got an idea or two to some things that we could do without too much trouble that we would really be easy to build into our routine that would be good for our hearts.
Well, I think, one thing we know about food that we've talked about many times is being able to actually implement some of these changes on a consistent basis. And I think we know enough about certain foods and how they can be helpful for preventing heart disease. But really the trick is, can people eat them often enough that it really makes a difference? And one of those foods we've talked about in the past that many of my clients have been successful with implementing is oats. Because oats, and you know when you cook oats, I think this always makes me think about it even more, when you cook them and you see that kind of gumminess mm-hmm. on them, kind of gooey, that type of fiber, that type of soluble fiber, it's called beta-glucan, the particular fiber in there. And the studies that have come out on cholesterol lowering and oatmeal are really consistent studies. Now, some people might see a drop of 10 points or 15 or 20. It's not as if it's going to work the same way as a cholesterol lowering medicine necessarily. It's not going to work that significantly, but still, that is a big jump for a lot of people. I have a lot of clients I work with whose cholesterol levels are right around 200, or their LDL is right around 120, 130, 140, where we really want to bring those down a little bit. And so maybe a drop of 10 or 15 points in cholesterol is great. And the key there really is to consider, maybe having a full cup of cooked oatmeal every day. So a packet's about a half cup. And that's great, too. And it might be that, maybe you have that in the morning, and as a snack, you're adding another half cup of cooked oats sometime. Those little packets are great to take to work and to just have with you. And another thing that works is there are several of the cereals that are the dry oat square cereals. Mm-hmm. And about a cup of that is the same amount of fiber as a half cup of cooked oats. So you could add that as a snack instead of a granola bar or something during the day. Well, maybe a cup of that cereal, which tastes good and would be another addition, so that the oats would really be enough on a significant level and consistently to hopefully drop your lipids a little bit. And that's an easy thing to do, and it's also not very expensive.
Yeah, okay, very good. Let's talk with another listener. Caller on line one in Urbana. Hi.
Hi, yeah. It occurred to me when you were talking to the previous caller, you didn't mention green leafy vegetables. As something to maybe want to avoid, because you touched on the thinners, but you didn't mention that specifically, and so I wonder if that might not be something to do.
Yeah, well, that's a good point. We think foods that are high in vitamin K, sometimes we really monitor that when someone is on a blood thinner, because it can affect how thin the blood becomes if someone's on Coumadin or a blood thinner, because vitamin K can clot the blood, and so. In this case, yeah, I mean, it's, I guess, potential, I guess, if you think about it, of foods that might be real high in vitamin K would clot the blood faster. And I don't know if that would be that might actually be a positive in a way if the blood is clotting and someone is healing faster. But that certainly, I don't know if someone's not on a blood thinning medication, if you could get enough vitamin K in food that it would affect blood thinning that much. But when you do take medication, but it certainly can. So it is something, that's another good point, something to think about.
Thanks.
Next, we talk with another band. Line two, hi.
Hi. I was wondering, I guess because it's winter and we have a lot of root vegetables, turnips, parsnips, mm-hmm. beets. I'm wondering about the nutritional content of those vegetables.
Well, those are great vegetables. I mean, like you say, they're root vegetables. They would be, from a caloric standpoint, generally a little higher in carbohydrates.
Okay.
Beets typically, though, are not as high as we might think. They're actually still considered, if we looked at them from a standpoint of starches and carbohydrate with diabetes, for example, we would count them as sort of the non-starchy ones. But they all are great sources. I mean, they're great sources of fiber. And particularly you look at something like beets, and just by looking at the color, you can see how nutritious they are, because as we know, the antioxidants really are held in the color of the food. So they're great, great sources. And I think what this gets to, too, is a chance to kind of get back to a starch that's more of a natural starch. And so you get more fiber. You're going to get some additional. Some of these have some iron. They've got some other vitamins and minerals that can be helpful that are naturally in there. And so as opposed to, let's say, always having the pasta or bread or rice or something like that, this could be your starch, which would be a great option, too, and a little bit lower calorie than those other starches. So it's a wonderful way to use some different vegetables that we might not typically see.
Okay, thanks.
You're very welcome. Thanks for the call this afternoon. I'm thinking of roasted carrots and parsnips.
Right. Doesn't that sound good now? Yeah. Boy, that'd be good for dinner.
And also, one of the things that we've been enjoying is red cabbage.
Right. I could tell you a story about red cabbage.
Yeah.
A few days ago when it snowed, and I took my daughter outside, and we were out playing in the yard, and we ended up playing this kind of fun game. That we were back in the tundra, of course, and we were trying to find scavenge for food. And we had brought out some a carrot and some potatoes and some red cabbage that I had found in the bottom of the fridge that was half chopped up. I think it was from New Year's, actually, and that was the rest of it. And we brought it out because we were going to try to use all those things for snowmen. Well, it wouldn't work out. So we ended up getting our fire pit, and we made a fire as if we were trying to have the old time. And we actually grilled on a stick some red cabbage, and it was really good.
Really?
Surprisingly. She loved it, too. So you never know how you're going to use red cabbage.
I thought you were going to tell us that maybe what you did with your snowman was to make him or her a redhead.
Well, that's what we had intended originally. And then since we couldn't get the snow to stick, we got to think what we could do. And I thought, well, let's make a fire out here. And that's what we did in the snow. It was really fun.
Yeah. Somebody on our block made a snowman this past weekend.
So, yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. It's going fast, though, now, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, that red
47 degrees.
Oh, I know. It's all melting. The red cabbage, though, is a great idea because cabbage in general is just so good for you, too. I mean, it's one of those foods that is inexpensive. Very good for you. A lot of the, you know, it's in the family of the broccoli and, of course, cauliflower and Brussels sprouts. So it's very high in anti-cancer nutrients. And it's, again, not very expensive. So just to steam cabbage for a side at night or something is a great idea. And the red cabbage, of course, has more nutrients because of the color.
Yeah.
And it cooks up really sweet. That's one thing I like about red cabbage. It's very sweet when it's steamed.
Yeah. You can braise it also with a little with some tomato. And
yes.
It's very good. So how long do you, if you're going to cook some red cabbage on a stick, how long do you cook it?
We cooked it probably about 4 or 5 minutes, just holding it over the fire. And surprisingly, it was very good.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's a great adventure.
It was.
You know, and speaking of adventure, you know, there are some things in the produce department that maybe we haven't experienced.
Mm-hmm.
So we have an adventure.
Well, and the listener was talking about kohlrabi. That's another one of my favorite vegetables. And we'll often, we don't eat it as much as I'd like to, but we'll chop that up and we'll saute that, sometimes with a little potatoes or carrots. And that's really good, too. And just as another, you know, different type of flavor to think about.
Listeners, if you've got a question, a comment for registered dietitian Susan Kundrat, give us a call. 333-9455. That's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455. This is a program we do with Susan. Generally, it's Susan. Last month, we had a substitute, and also we didn't do it on the same Monday as we usually do. But this is a topic we take up once a month, usually with Susan Kundrat, and usually on the first Monday of the month here on the Afternoon Magazine. Well, we talked about oats and heart health. What about legumes?
Legumes are perfect. I mean, they fit in there so nicely and, again, not expensive at all. You know, just particularly if you buy dry legumes and you cook those, and you could cook a whole pot of those, and you can still freeze those afterwards, too. So then bring those out and microwave them. I mean, it's a great way to get some of that good gummy fiber. I think, in general, if people are really concerned about cardiovascular health and cancer prevention and general promotion of their own wellness, one simple substitution is to think what they're eating as their starch in a meal. And, again, we kind of talked about maybe some other vegetables that would serve that purpose besides a potato or the rice or pasta, but beans are just another way to get a little protein, which is good. And also they too have that type of gummy fiber, whether it's a black-eyed pea, or whether you've got black beans or red beans and chili, whatever it might be. And that's a good way to increase the fiber. You know, and what we think happens, what we know happens from studies, is that type of gummy fiber tends to bind on to some of the cholesterol-producing products in the body and takes them out of the system. So a very simple way is just to, even if you don't want to make them from dry beans, just to buy the canned beans, rinse them, and have that as one of your sides, or make a quick black bean salad. You know, throw in some tomato and onion. It's very simple to just think of that as your side. It's also very filling. So as far as calories, you don't have to eat very much, but you get full faster. So very helpful.
Yeah. Let's take another call. A listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hi. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about the use of casein protein supplements as opposed to whey protein for kids that are trying to, you know, do the weightlifting and muscle building and all that kind of stuff. And also, if there's anything new on nitric oxide, I had called, I don't know, several months ago, and you were good enough to talk about that. But is there anything new on research in that? And I will hang up and listen.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. There aren't as many casein supplements out there. When you think about milk protein, we typically think it's casein and whey. Those are the two main proteins that you find in milk. And most of the supplements that I see and that my athletes use are the whey protein. There has been a lot of research on whey protein in particular for muscle building and for recovery. And what I subscribe to and what I think is probably most beneficial is to primarily use whey, but also have some casein and maybe some soy in your diet as well, because, of course, you're going to naturally get both casein and whey with milk. But typically the studies on whey protein have looked real solid as far as strength building and recovery. So I guess that would be my preference working with an athlete. But casein is a good protein. All the proteins, soy, casein, and whey, when you get them in supplemental form or powdered form, they're all going to be digested a little bit differently. And so anytime you mix the proteins together, and you again would naturally do this when you add it to milk, then you get perhaps some proteins that start recovering a little faster and some that take a little longer, and we think that's beneficial to the muscle. And so there certainly would be no problem if you found a casein supplement that you liked and had that and had whey as well. I would make sure the whey was in there too to be able to use both. And, you know, again, there's going to be a lot more interest in egg protein and egg protein for athletes and powdered egg protein and using that as well. So I think we're going to see more interest in that too. One of the newsletters that I get, Nutrition Action Health Letter, I brought that in today, and there's a whole article in there about food myths. And one of them is that we get plenty of protein. And that's actually, as they mention here, is really a myth for a lot of people. For athletes trying to build muscle mass, it is considerably more protein that someone needs. And for someone who's elderly, often they don't get enough protein to maintain muscle mass. So that's a problem. And there are always going to be people who do overeat on it, but there are many people who don't. And so I think, you know, looking at some of these supplements with protein can be helpful if it's just a powdered form. One caution I would say is that there are some of the protein supplements that are out there that also do have other substances in them that are banned by NCAA or other organizations, or just maybe some things that you might not think of. I looked at a typical weight gain supplement that's just a whey protein supplement the other day, and it never used to have creatine in it, and the new formulation of the same brand has creatine. So just being aware that there are other things that might be added. So that, I guess, answers, you know, the thought about the casein. Nitric oxide is a supplement that's really popular right now, or the arginine is an amino acid that is in this supplement that is being used by a lot of bodybuilders to increase muscle mass and increase power in lifting. And still, what we know about this type of supplement, you'll see them in things like NO2 or NO3 or NO Explode or Nano NO2. There's all kinds of things that are out there that are popular. And the idea is if you take the supplement with this arginine, that it would make your blood vessels dilate. And particularly if you partner that with creatine or some other muscle-building supplement, the theory is that that supplement's going to get into your muscles very quickly because blood flow is going to be increased and you're going to feel a rush and you're going to train a lot harder. And to date, we still have very little evidence that it actually works for people who are weightlifting. We do have now a lot more anecdotal evidence at the least that there could be some potential harm with using these supplements. And I can say, and I might have mentioned this before, but I have had athletes who've had terrible problems with headaches and, you know, problems where they even went to the emergency room taking these supplements because the changes in blood flow. Incidentally, I was giving a presentation last week. I was in St. Louis, and then I worked with a college in Iowa for a couple days and worked with their athletes and their coaches. And this supplement came up several times with some of the male athletes there. And one of the athletes told me that he finally went off of it because he was getting so many headaches. And he said 2 days after he went off the supplement, he stopped getting the headaches, and it was really bothering him. He said it felt good taking it because he did feel this rush when he weightlifted, but it always gave him terrible headaches then after that. And so we're talking about how that's a good sign that maybe it's not smart to take something if it's giving you some of these negative feelings too. So I would still be very cautious with any of the nitric oxide supplements because of that.
Okay, let's take another call. A listener on a cell phone line 2. Good afternoon.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Hi. I have a couple of questions. First of all, how much protein does a person normally need?
The protein amount is based on body weight and also based on activity. And so as a general guide for someone moderately active, let's say they're not training for anything, they're not really weightlifting, they're just maybe trying to be active 30 or 45 minutes most days, you would take your weight and divide it in half. Your weight in pounds. So if someone weighed 160 pounds, then we'd try to shoot for around 80 grams of protein. That's kind of a general recommendation. That's more than what you'd find from our national guidelines. National guidelines are typically going to be a little bit less than that. But when some of these new recommendations are coming out, when we look at percentages of the diet, they tend to be a little wider range, maybe a little bit higher for some people. So individually, when I work with clients, I try to make sure they're getting at least half of their body weight in grams of protein, and all the way up to 1 gram per pound if someone is trying to actively put on lean body mass. So, for example, today I met with an athlete. We were talking about this. He's trying to get stronger and get leaner. And for his body, it would be appropriate for him to have 1 gram per pound. If he's 150 pounds, then I would set up his plan for 150 grams of protein. He's definitely trying to get more power and stronger as he's trying to drop some body fat. So in that case, we think going up maybe to 1 gram per pound is beneficial. And somewhere in between for those who maybe are training but not necessarily trying to build a lot of lean mass. I will typically have athletes I'm working with on 0.7 to 0.8 grams of protein per pound because they certainly don't want to lose any lean mass, but they might be in a point where they're just trying to get more fit, but they're not trying to get bigger. Uh-huh. And that seems to be the range from research that is a good range.
So if an individual is trying to lose weight, do they need more protein or less protein?
They may benefit from more protein. They may benefit from that upper end of protein. Right. The interesting studies that have come out of here, out of the University of Illinois, Don Lehman and his work that he's done with a lot of other researchers on campus, and as well as some other studies that have come out in the last few years, you know, found that if you have calories equal for people who are trying to lose weight, and a lot of these studies are on women taking in 1,500, 1,600 calories, that those on about 30% protein, 30% of the diet is protein, tended to maintain muscle mass better as they lost weight. And so the other thing we know about protein is it's very satisfying. And so it may be helpful because someone may not feel like they need to eat as much if they're getting more protein throughout the day. And again, this is anywhere near a high protein, low carb diet. It's just maybe shifting protein up 20, 30, 40 grams for some people while they drop carbohydrate down a little bit. And there definitely is an effect, you know, making someone feel more satisfied when they eat. And of course, that's a big, big help when you're trying to lose weight.
Right. Now, one other question is, and I don't know if this is something in your area or not, but do you not have any nutritional help for people that might have eczema?
Well, you know, what we think about with eczema and any type of skin concerns is, first of all, fatty acids. And so, you know, definitely I would look at essential fatty acid intake. Is someone taking in enough good fats, monounsaturated fats, nuts and seeds, olive oil, avocados, things like that, because the fat is very helpful with skin. And there have been some studies looking at additional omega-3s and skin help, perhaps extra vitamin C, because vitamin C is, again, helpful with repair of tissue, which includes the skin. And so those would be nutrients really to kind of look at and focus on to make sure that maybe those are up a little bit. And so there may be some additional needs for essential fatty acids and maybe some additional omega-3 in particular that could be beneficial with skin health with eczema.
Where do you find the information of what is appropriate just for a normal person and so that you know how to judge on how much more you might need?
Mm-hmm. Well,
where do you get that information?
I would look at, you know, our general recommendation for health for fat is anywhere between 20 and 30% of the diet. So if I have a client with eczema or other skin concerns where we're trying to make sure they're doing everything, I would probably make sure they're on the top end of that. So 30% of the diet would be from fat. And then trying to make sure that, again, a lot of those fat sources are not saturated fat. They're not necessarily fatty meats or high-fat milks or things like that, but they're more the nuts and the seeds and those kinds of things. Supplementation with fish oil is generally considered very safe at 1 to 3 grams a day. And usually a fish oil tablet is, you know, a capsule is 1 gram, but it just depends on the brand. Mm-hmm. And again, kind of like we mentioned earlier, it could be a blood thinner too, so you'd want to make sure that that's okay with your physician, or there's no other medication that could be problematic with that. But there have been some studies looking at that, and that those might be helpful things to do.
Okay, well, thank you for your help.
You're welcome. Next, we talk with a listener in Champaign, line 3. Hi.
I think that might be me, and actually, the last caller pretty much asked my question because I was also interested in how many grams of protein a day you need. Right, so I think my question was pretty well answered.
Okay, well, thanks for the call this afternoon. And next we go to a listener on a cell phone, line 1. Hi.
Hi, thank you. My sister-in-law makes fun of my 86-year-old mother because she's concerned about getting enough protein. And but I think she's right to make sure she gets enough protein. Is there any written information that would support this? You mentioned a newsletter that you had gotten or brought with you today. Is there a website or anything where I can get information to support that she's right?
Sure. I'll give you the newsletter name, and this is actually a really good sound newsletter. It's called Nutrition Action Health Letter, and it's put out by the Center for Science in the Public Interest. And so it's very well researched, a lot of good information. And I think the website, I'm trying to find it, but I think the website is www.cspi.net.
Okay. Okay, good.
Yes, and that would be worth, I think it's net.com or .org. And you could look at that too. Yes, it's cspinet.org. And
okay.
You can order the newsletter there. And sometimes they'll often have some of the articles posted that you can just pull down off of the web. And they, you know, that's one place because they kind of gather the information from different studies. But I will say, too, that there has been more of a concern with elderly population getting enough protein. You know, just like we're concerned about getting enough calcium and how vitamin D is a big issue with the elderly population or not getting outside. And that seems to play a big role with falls and bone breakages and that kind of thing. But people don't realize that when we lose protein in the body, when we lose muscle mass, that we also lose the strength around our bones, and that can affect bone strength as well. So maintaining muscle, you know, there's a big reason to maintain lean body mass as we age. And so I think the other thing I see just as a practical point as a dietitian is some of my clients who are older, it's very difficult to make meat, you know, they're not going to cook as much. And they may feel like they can't eat eggs or things because maybe their cholesterol is high. So I start kind of dropping out that cholesterol problem as somebody gets older. I'd rather have them have the protein.
Right.
That's important.
Yeah, me too. I think that's more important too. So, and she doesn't have any rotator cuffs anymore, so she has to lean on the counter to do any cooking.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
So
she's right. I'm so glad. I figured she was. Thank you so much.
You're
Bye-bye.
Very welcome. Next, we take a call from Paris, Illinois, line 4. Hi.
Yeah, I'm interested in dating on food as far as that's safe, you know, on dairy products and on pop and on various things, there's a date on it. Sometimes it says sell-by, sometimes it's a use-by. And mm-hmm. I wonder how long, is that commercial or is that, are those really good guidelines? And how long do you, how do you approach those? How long can you use Vermelk to sell by the 24th? How good is it for after that?
Well, you bring up a really good point because we deal with this issue. I deal with it with different in different capacities as a dietitian and some of the boards I'm on and things like that. You know, I think they're guidelines. I think, you know, the milk, here's a good example of the milk. I was at my mother's this weekend and I always try to clean out a refrigerator because it's difficult for her to figure out what's old and what's not old. And the date was fine on this milk. You know, it maybe was 3 or 4 days before purchase by. But it was definitely bad. And so in that case, you'd have thought it would still have been fine. But, of course, I don't know if it was left out or what had happened when I wasn't there. But I do think you have to kind of use your own senses with those things, too. Typically, I know food companies will even put out recommendations. Let's say if they have – if there's soup, for example, and it's past the date, people will say, well, is it okay to eat? Well, generally there's a leeway in there where it's still okay to eat after a while, and we'll have pretty good sense of that. But probably a good place to look is with the FDA, FDA.gov, because on that website they do have different listings of food safety and different foods and how long they can stay in the fridge, how long they can stay in the freezer, and kind of what to, you know, generally keep in mind for that. I would say generally if something says purchase by, if it is a milk product, that my rule of thumb would be I probably wouldn't keep it, you know, more than a week after that.
Okay.
But often it depends on how many times it's been opened up and exposed to air. And, you know, cottage cheese is a good example. If it's never opened, it might be fine after that date a little bit. But if it's been opened several times, you may, it may not be good anymore. Because
pharmaceuticals are the same way. They put a date on there and, you know, even over-the-counter stuff, if you is there any safety date on any of that kind of property?
Right. I mean, we kind of use those dates as guidelines, but we know that some of those, you know, it's good to throw them away after that date, but, you know, it's not to say that it wouldn't be good a week later or something like that. But I think with food safety, too, if there's a date on there, I'm always better safe than sorry. I mean, I might look up something from FDA or try to find out if it's a particular food that's okay. Sometimes the date is more related to the fact that it just degrades. In other words, it might be frozen vegetables and it just isn't going to be good anymore. You could eat it and it might be okay from a food safety standpoint. But
when you open it up and it looks like it's from another century.
Yeah. Then some of the common sense is good too. But I think that definitely I'd be pretty careful on things like milk products and meats and those kinds of things that could potentially be a bigger problem.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Thanks for the call this afternoon. And I have seen products where they say, do not consume after
a certain date.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Vacuum-packed fish.
Oh, yeah.
Cured fish.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah.
So the wording is important.
Right.
Too. Best buy, sell by,
mm-hmm.
do not consume after.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think, you know, that brings up another thing to think about when you do shop is if you can go to the back of a line of orange juice or milk or something like that, do that. Or I've certainly gotten home and had yogurts that were a week late that were still in the fridge and, you know, at the grocery store and I was in a hurry and I didn't catch them. And so as much as the stores try to keep that stuff fresh, sometimes it's easy to miss things.
Yeah. Or keep in mind how quickly you're going to consume something,
a
product like that. If you're going to, you know, eat it, you know, as soon as you get home, that's one thing. But if it's going to sit in the refrigerator for a week, maybe it's more important.
Right.
Let's take another call. A listener in Champaign, line one. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm calling about vitamin D. And I understand you must have calcium with that. Is that correct?
Well, yes, the vitamin D and calcium work together for absorption. And so we typically think if you're going to take calcium, it's good to have vitamin D with it. Or even if you drink a glass of milk, it'll typically be fortified with vitamin D. Vitamin D kind of acts as a helper to calcium. And so the two of them together help the calcium get absorbed. And the vitamin D has to be there, too, or it's really difficult to build strong bone. So occasionally we'll have people who are doing fine with their calcium intake, but their vitamin D levels are so low in the body that they're not actually absorbing the calcium. And so they're having trouble with bone problems, and it may not be due to calcium at all. It just might be their helper's not there. The vitamin D is not there.
All right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
You're welcome. Let's take another call. Listener in Champaign, line two. Hi.
Hi. I'm a 50-year-old male, pretty active, and I'm a contractor. I notice myself driving around, stopping at the fast food place and all that, so my New Year's thing is to cut that out. So I made four little tubs, little Rubbermaid deals, and one of them I got rice cakes, one I got raisins, one I got carrots, and one I got a couple peanut butter and jelly whole wheat sandwiches. Could you comment, or sometimes I substitute a hummus sandwich, and I'm a vegetarian but not vegan. Could you comment on that? Are some of those things not as good a substitute as I might think?
Well, first of all, that's exactly what you should be doing. That's great. I mean, to have, you know, we will eat well if the food's available. So taking that extra time to make your containers of healthy snacks is great, because I'm sure that that has made a big difference in your overall nutritional intake. And the thing that when I'm looking at this, too, that I wrote down the list of foods you mentioned, and I think what's happening is you're getting a lot more potassium and a lot less sodium because you're not eating the fast food, which is just really good in terms of blood pressure, too. So the things that everything that you've got there is great. A couple suggestions I might make. Rice cakes are really good, particularly if you're watching calories. But if you're a contractor and you're if your weight's good and you're burning calories, like I would expect you would be with your job, you could even think of things like maybe adding some whole wheat crackers into that, even whole wheat Triscuits or whole wheat thins or Wasa crackers or some of those things that have a lot more fiber than the rice cakes, because that would just enhance what you're already doing nutritionally. And then I might look, you know, for a little extra protein in there as well. So things like you've got your peanut butter and jelly, which is great, maybe some additional sunflower seeds or soy nuts or another, you know, quick handful of some type of protein that would be beneficial for you too, is would be great. And then you can, you've got your raisins, which is great. I would just rotate different fruits and veggies when you can. Baby carrots are super. Maybe throw in some grapes instead of raisins. Of course, they're kind of the same thing, but they have some different nutrients involved. Or even something like apples. If you sliced apples and threw a little orange juice on them and then drained it off, those will stay all day in a cooler without getting brown. So just some different options for what you could do fruit and veggie-wise, too. Sliced cucumber, sliced broccoli, cauliflower, that kind of stuff. So you're getting a wide range of nutrients that you could mix in. But I think this is great. I think this is really what you want to be thinking about doing. Like, what can you control in your day? And when you have food with you like this, you're just so much more apt to eat well. So I really commend you on what you've decided to do.
Well, thanks. To follow up, I kind of like the rice cakes. Are they bad for you, or just kind of value less, or is there any, you know, they're organic, blah, blah, from the health food store?
Oh, yeah. I mean, well, that brings up a good point. There are rice cakes now that are a little bit higher in fiber because they're actually somewhat brown rice cakes, so those would be the best. But rice cakes in general are a great food. They're a great snack. The only thing is some of the rice cakes out there just don't have much fiber because it's the processed rice. So you might just rotate those around. And you might even look for something. I don't know if you've ever tried a product. There are things like soy crisps that are out there that are rice cakes but have a little more protein in them. And a lot of people who don't eat meat, those are a helpful way to get a little extra protein as well. But no, the rice cakes are fine. You just may want to rotate some other high-fiber items as well. The other thing that's really good here is you could even put in some things like frosted mini wheats, or we talked before about the oat square-type cereal that's out there. There are many different brands that are real high-fiber, high-gummy fiber. And so that might be another option for a grain that would also boost your fiber intake too.
Historically, I'm probably, for a guy who's been a vegetarian for 30-some years, probably about as heavy as you could imagine a person could be, as active as I am. So I kind of figured that maybe it was the fact that I like cheese so much, and with some initial difficulty, I've pretty well cut it out for the most part. Are there any precautions that I should be aware of if I'm cutting out this cheese dairy intake and substituting mostly tofu and hummus?
Well, if you substitute those foods, then you're certainly getting other proteins, which would be my first concern, is are you getting enough protein? And I might suggest, if you're taking foods with you, even something like a cheese stick to add in is good, because that gives you a little calcium that we just have been talking about too. And it's not too high in fat. It's 2%. It's not going to give you any problem with too much saturated fat. So if you like it, that might be another good option that's portable too. But just as you mentioned, if you cut something out, you're putting else something else in that's going to give you particularly some of that protein. And then you still want to make sure you're getting 3 or 4 good calcium sources a day. So it might be that if you drink milk, maybe that's what you're going to do in the morning and at night. You drink a glass or two of milk, so you still get that protein, you still get calcium, even if you're not having it during the day, but you don't get all the fat, as long as it's skim milk.
Thanks a lot.
You're very welcome. Next, we take a call from a listener in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
I also have a question about vitamin D. Do you know Dr. Christiane Northrup?
Yes.
I heard her say that you need 2,000 units of vitamin D a day, that 400 isn't enough, which is what I always heard was enough. And then also somebody else said you need vitamin D3. So can you comment on those two things?
Well, I think this whole area of vitamin D, it really brings up a good question, because vitamin D3 is the absorbable form of vitamin, the best absorbable form of vitamin D. So yes, and most supplements are, but not all of them. So that's something that you can look at. As far as the amount that's appropriate, many people believe that 200 or 400 IUs a day, or even 800 IUs a day, is not going to be enough. The upper level, that's our national guideline, is 2,000 IUs a day. And so you wouldn't want to go over that, because those levels are developed to say, well, what might be the level where it would become a problem if you had too much more than that. That aside, I've had clients who've been on 10 times that amount because their D levels were low to begin with. And so if it's a therapeutic dose, it's going to be
2,000?
Yes, 2,000 is...
10?
Mm-hmm. And those were people, though, whose D levels were very low. So it was a clinical matter. Their physicians were putting them on extra because they were so low to begin with. And so I guess it brings us around to the question of having your vitamin D levels checked, which you can have checked. Sometimes you have to really, you know, encourage your physician to do that. But if anybody has a history of bone problems or stress fractures or history of osteoporosis, then often they'll want to check vitamin D levels too. And living in this part of the country, we just, you know, we don't get much sunshine. So we don't get the levels of vitamin D that people are going to get if they're outside in warm climates all the time. And so I guess the idea that you mentioned of 2,000 IUs, that would be that upper level. So I'm not saying everybody would need that by any means, but if you felt you needed more and, you know, within your physician, that would be probably a point where you wouldn't want to go over, unless there were reasons from a clinical standpoint to do that.
So if a person's older, like 80 years old, would she need more?
Well, it's difficult to tell. There are certainly older people who have good vitamin D stores, and for them, maybe 800 or 1,000 IUs is fine for the day. And, of course, we get it in other food, too. So it's not as if we're only going to get it in supplement. We certainly get it in anything that's vitamin D fortified. But that 2,000...
What I'm asking is, does age make a difference?
Age can make a difference. Mm-hmm. And it may partly be due to someone's not eating as much. They're not getting as much in food. They're not outside as much, maybe. So they don't make as much from the sun. But it's an area that I really encourage my clients to have tested if they can, because it's something that we're finding it plays a lot of roles in a lot of different things besides bone health, too. And so it's real important that vitamin D levels are up where they should be.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Thanks for the call this afternoon. Thanks to everyone who called this afternoon. And we've taken care of everyone, and we've used up the time.
Okay, that's good.
Flew by once again.
A lot of good questions.
Susan Kundrat is a registered dietitian. She joins us generally once a month, generally on the first Monday, usually on the first Monday of the month, to talk about diet and nutrition. Susan is a sports and wellness nutritionist and the owner of Nutrition on the Move.